where from there begins. Coming up the steep mountain pass, we come up on a civilian truck blocking the road, a big one, what we call a jingle truck. No way around it, no way to push it uphill, no real way to back out, when all of a sudden the Talibs start raining on us. That trap was ill, man. We couldn't even call in air support because they'd figured out it was a dead spot for radio reception. They had two fronts pinning us down, firing RPGs from across and above, capping us with small arms fire. That might have been the worst tactical position I was ever in. The field manual doesn't prep you for that one, not the terrain we were in. Nothing does. Shireese delivered him a glass of water, then lingered beside him. DeMarcus took a sip and continued. The lieutenant wanted to blast that truck with the 203, try to blow it out of our way. But like we all told him, no matter how much fire you get going on that thing, you're still gonna have a few tons of hot steel that you ain't pushing up that incline. Only other option was to try to hotwire it. Thing was, they'd probably booby-trapped it. Their whole attack, their positioning, all that, it was all so tight that you got to assume the truck was wired to blow. So whoever you're sending up there probably ain't coming back. But then again now, you got 43 guys who might not make it if you don't try. That's combat math. It sucks. This specialist we called Shug, he was our hotwire man, so he was going up. The platoon sergeant at the time, he ordered Cameron to go up with him to provide cover. Now to me, this seemed like a pretty stupid choice, because Cameron's untested, you know? This is his first damn firefight. But I guess Terry, that was the platoon sarge, he didn't want to send one of his guys up there. Because his guys, you know, he understood the assets they brought to the platoon. He knew all about their wives and kids, but he didn't know anything about Cameron yet. That's combat math, too. We're all watching from the rear, doing our best to give them two some cover fire. Cameron and Shug get up to the truck, and Shug lies down inside, gets to work. And then Cambo, he starts into doing this thing, almost like he's trying to draw fire, running around like a rabbit or something. The lieutenant's watching, thinking he's panicking, thinking we're fucked. But I'm seeing different. I didn't know nothing about Cameron then, but I knew he wasn't panicking. How old did you know? The way he was laying down fire. You hear enough of it, and after a while it's like hearing someone play a guitar or something. Someone strumming an M249 the right way, man, you can almost hear music. There's a rhythm. There's almost a tune in there. What it is, see, it's the sound of control. You hate hearing it from the other side, but from your side, man, those are your beats. You know what I'm saying? And every second till that truck started up, him and Shug figuring they're dead, Cameron doing his rabbit runs with the Dragunov trained on his ass, a sniper trying to miss him, everyone of the enemy knowing what was happening and where to gear their fire, that was the sound. So, the truck, Euclide clarified. It wasn't booby-trapped. The truck wasn't wired, right. That was the good thing. But the damn second Shug sat up to drive, he took a bullet in the neck. Euclide shook his head, in a show of reverent horror. But DeMarcus seemed to be relishing this part of the story, his voice pitching higher and faster. So Cambo, though, listen, he crawls into the truck and shifts it into reverse, lying down on the seat. Shug, he's still conscious, but Cameron has to grab Shug's legs to push his feet onto the clutch and the gas, you know, like he's milking a cow. And then we're all watching that truck come lurching backwards, watching it crash right into the front of our lead vehicle. Bam! Why backwards? Yeah, that's exactly what the lieutenant's screaming. But Cameron figured there wasn't no way he was going to get that truck forward. There's bullets coming through that door. There's Swiss cheese in it. And any second now, a grenade's going to come busting into that cab. Lights out. Best he can figure, he might get that truck moved 20 feet uphill. Then the next guy coming up to shove his dead body out the way to drive is just going to get him moved another 20. So he cranks the steering wheel all the way left and throws the truck into neutral. Pulls Shug out of the cab through the passenger door, kind of drags him back till the medics get up there. I'm watching Cameron waving his arms for us to roll back right about the same time the lieutenant is losing it completely. He's wanting to shoot Cameron instead of the enemy. But when that lead vehicle backs up a few feet, I see what Cambo done. And I'm like, okay, roger that shit. We order everyone to pull back a ways from rear to front. And when that lead vehicle backs up fast as it could go, the jingle truck stays smooshed to its front, rolling back until its rear wheels tilt over the side, and then that whole motherfucking truck just tips right off the side of the cliff. Euclide was writing, trying to get as much of this story as he could into his notepad. Whatever image of Cameron he'd allowed to fester in his mind was blurring now, its pixels scrambled by this new information. What he was hearing didn't match the profile of someone who could be literally paralyzed by fear. He went casting about his mind for another potential motive to fit Janice's theory. "So our route was clear after that," DeMarcus went on. "We moved up to better terrain, called in an airstrike, got a pair of warthogs that blew the face off that ridge, and we counterattacked. And we pretty much wiped them out. We lost 3 guys in that fight. Not Shug, though. They stitched him up. 3 guys instead of 43. Thing is, like I was saying earlier, you can break that story down and find about a dozen instinctual decisions Cameron made that'll tell you what kind of soldier he was. He should have got some chest candy for that when you ask me. That should have been a medal."
"And how did he respond to that? His first combat experience?"
"Well, first thing he had to respond to was getting his ass chewed out by the lieutenant. There were guys said I was a textbook motherfucker, but him? You either build the Legos like the instructions say, or you don't take them out the damn box."
DeMarcus rolled his eyes before gathering his face into a thoughtful frown.
"After that, though, with Cameron, same way he responded to anything else. Smoke a cigarette, kind of stick off to the side. He had Shug's blood all over him. He threw up a little while later, but that's normal."
"Was he especially close to anyone in the platoon?" An inscrutable half-grin crept onto Lockwood's face, Euclide thinking he might be weighing whether to answer this question with a joke. A glance to his sister yielded DeMarcus the faintest of nods, even more inscrutable.
"I'd have to say that was me, sir," he told Euclide.
"You? Why was that?"
DeMarcus's eyes widened as he blew the air from his cheeks.
"Oh, man, I don't know. Put aside the difference in rank, you know, me and him just got along. We could hang good. We both played high school ball. We was both from down south, even though obviously he's white and I ain't."
Prompted by all those Indian artifacts, Euclide couldn't resist breaking in.
"This is totally irrelevant," he admitted, "and I hope you'll pardon the curiosity of a foreigner. But your grandfather, he told me he was Cherokee?"
"Straight up,"
DeMarcus confirmed. "We got Cherokee in the blood. We got, Shy? Melungeon ancestors from up Tennessee way? My dad's granddad, he was white. And you can see we got some Africa going on. It's funny, when I was a kid messing around with Play-Doh, you know, I found that when I mixed all the colors together, I got the exact same shade as my skin. And that was like this light bulb moment. Like, all right, you mix some of everything together, and what you get is me."
The beam of DeMarcus's grin was like another lamp turning on in the room, and Euclide felt happy for the swerve. Shireese, however, seemed coiled more than ever. The baby was drawing her into the kitchen, bleeding for more Cheerios to replace the ones strewn across the floor.
"But also," DeMarcus went on, "well, you must have driven through hell in getting here, right? Then you probably noticed there ain't a ton of black faces around here. We're in the Blue Ridge Mountains, man. I mean, we're in White County, Georgia, you feel me?"
He laughed at this. Clearly not for the first time. A lifelong absurdity.
"So what I'm saying to you is, I grew up around guys like Cameron. Wasn't like he was something weird or foreign to me. I mean, I didn't gotta like that country shit he listens to. But it ain't like I didn't grow up hearing it."
Euclide leaned in, wanting to capitalize on this higher watt rapport.
"Did he confide in you?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, did he tell you anything about his home life? Or his personal life?"
"Yeah, of course he did. Especially when we was at Outpost Gila, with a lot of time to kill. I knew he had a wild-ass sister, like the one I got."
From the kitchen, Shireese grunted to acknowledge receipt of her brother's zing.
"I knew his daddy wasn't around, same way mine wasn't. He lost his mama, same as me. He never got to play college ball, I didn't neither. We just had some shit in common."
"He confided a great deal in you, it sounds like."
"Look, man, you're gonna learn a whole lot about people when you're stuck up in a little combat outpost for an Afghan winter. But some of them guys, you're gonna learn shit you ain't never wanted to know."
"Then how would you describe Cameron Harris personally?"
DeMarcus drew his face into another thoughtful frown, but a soft one, with something far off in his eyes.
"Cameron was tough, you know, kind of raw around the edges. You get him in a group, man, you ain't gonna hear much out of him. But he had a righteous heart. You know what I'm saying?"
"A righteous heart," Euclide echoed.
Yeah, he was strong, you know, army strong and all that shit, but...
He tapped his chest.
Heart strong, too.
Would you say he was brave?
Euclida asked, thinking to aim a kill shot at Janice's theory about a motive.
Over there, you know, sometimes being brave is the same as being stupid,
DeMarcus said, a small laugh bubbling out of him.
And he was stupid sometimes. That's why I named him Cambo.
Can you explain that?
Naming him Cambo? You seen them old Rambo movies, right?
I'm aware of them, Euclida said.
This was in Paktika province again, little while later.
Euclida wasn't expecting a story, just an explanation, but settled in contentedly. DeMarcus's fluent and energetic way with war stories was making him discount his earlier suspicions about PTSD. But there was Shireese still. Now, with the baby in her arms, helicoptering close to her brother.
We got hooked up with an engineer company that was building a holding pen for some detainees, DeMarcus said. They'd found this little courtyard with a guard tower and was stringing up some razor wire, the standard shit, and then blew it up. We came under fire from about 30 or 40 Talibs, small arms, mortars, RPGs, the whole menu. We had an MRAP, but the moment the fuckers blew in, they took it out with a mortar round. Broke the gunner's arm, blinded the driver, just neutralized it with a single 60. So now we kind of fucked, right? It's like we're trapped inside a blender. We got enemy up in that guard tower now, we don't got shit for cover, and they're fixing to overrun us. And that's bad, you gotta understand. Because if they'd taken that courtyard, there wasn't hardly nothing between them and a command center down the highway. So Cameron, he's helping evacuate the wounded out of the MRAP. I'm right there with him when a bullet hits one of the wounded in the knee. And I remember him saying, God damn it, just like that. Just put out, you know, like he's playing poker and got his 10th crap hand in a row. And without orders, because nobody would have ever ordered him up there, he climbs up into the gunner's hatch and starts blasting that 50 cal. He's totally exposed up there. I mean, you should have seen his helmet afterwards.
DeMarcus's eyes were flickering with a distant glint, reminding Euclide of someone recounting an extravagant meal.
I ordered him out there, he said. Campbell says he never heard me, but I think he ignored me. He's just swiveling and shooting that 50. Bam, 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 bam. By this time, there's Talib's coming over the wall. I realize he's running black on ammo, so I get on in there and start loading for him, shouting the whole time for him to get his stupid ass down. I mean, he didn't have a chance up there. I load him a second box, he's still firing. Load him a third. And by the time that third box is running black, man, that courtyard's gone quiet. I don't know how many enemy he took out. Had to be more than a dozen.
Euclide looked up from the notes he was taking. No, Cameron Harris wasn't a coward. Janice had it wrong. Here was a young man who twice risked sacrificing himself to save others. For the first time since she'd uncorked that venomous theory, Euclide was sensing the warm radiance of a potential miracle. Its divine rebuttal. And while he knew miracles didn't work this way, Euclide was beginning to glimpse a framework of justice built into this one, as though walking had been Cameron's reward for the lives he'd saved.
That's the second time we could have lost the whole squad if Cameron hadn't pulled his Rambo shit,
DeMarcus was saying.
I remember afterwards, he's standing there smoking. He's so cheap he always smoked this nasty Afghan brand called Pine. Smelled like he was smoking kitty litter. And I come up to him like, you're a stupid motherfucker, you know that? And he's like, sorry, Sarge, I just lost my temper. So sincere, you know? Like a kid who just fouled out of a basketball game. Me, I just got to laughing my ass off. I mean, that was close to Medal of Honor shit right there, and he's saying sorry. That's the minute I...
He pulled up short. Some kind of switch got pulled, erasing DeMarcus's lamplight grin and replacing it with a melting expression of sudden agony or grief. Shireese moved in, patting the baby on her shoulder, her own expression mirroring her brother's. Euclide didn't know how to read this. Criminal and canon law in Italy had endowed him with little experience fielding war stories. But maybe this is how it went, he thought. You focus on a single point of light, like a stargazer, until the enormity of the darkness surrounding it smothers the glow. His gaze bounced between Shireese and her brother. The minutes you what? He prodded. DeMarcus raised his head, something new and solid in his eyes. The minute I knew what kind of soldier he was. Euclide cocked his head, studying him. "You sound like you admired Cameron very much," he offered.
DeMarcus said nothing. That new solidity Euclide noticed calcifying into stone-facedness. An aspect of his eyes in that moment was reflecting his lower legs, functional but bloodlessly metallic. Shireese dropped a hand down onto her brother's shoulder.
"Pretty sure, Cameron,"
she said to Euclide, as softly as he'd yet to hear her speak.
"Admired Dee just as much."
La sorella. Once again, Euclide felt the urge to underline that word in his notes.
"Can you talk about when you were injured?" he asked, thinking maybe he was merely positioned too early in this story, that fast-forwarding might bring clarity.
DeMarcus's account of the story aligned with the one Cameron had furnished Father Ace, with one exception that Euclide failed to catch. In the version DeMarcus told, it was Cameron, not him, who'd wanted to check something out on the ridge, when they'd left the Afghan National Army soldiers and strayed to the spot where DeMarcus's boot heel tamped the soil above a landmine that had been lying dormant since the Soviet-Afghan War of the 1980s. Boom.
"It seems astonishing," Euclide said afterward, "that you survived."
DeMarcus sketched how he'd done that. The 47 surgeries. The way surgeons rebuilt his urethra using tissue from his cheek. The 9 months he'd spent at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, followed by the year he lived in a dorm on the hospital's campus for physical and occupational therapy. The $100,000 robotic arm they'd fitted onto him that he almost never uses, not since the third time he punched a hole in the bathroom wall reaching for his toothbrush. For the first time, Euclide saw a smile creep onto Shireese's face. Listening to her brother describe what had to be the most painful and difficult period in his life, the grueling aftermath of that landmine appeared to relax her. She tickled the baby, rocking on her heels. It was pride, Euclide saw. It was warm, warranted pride.
"You didn't stay in touch with Cameron Harris afterward?" Euclide asked, close to wrapping it up. Shireese's newfound ease dissolving some of the weird mystery of the way she'd been acting until then.
A low vibration suddenly thrummed the room, which Euclide immediately traced to Shireese. Another mention of Cameron Harris, and her ease popped like a soap bubble.
Why?
She was staring at her brother's face with close and tender scrutiny, but she was also, Euclide felt, transmitting signals to him on a sibling frequency that Euclide could sense but not decode.
"Nah, we really didn't," DeMarcus said. "We had some serious healing to do, both of us. And after a while, I guess it was like, keep looking that way,"
twirling a finger toward the future.
Something about this explanation must have struck him as insufficient, because DeMarcus added, "Some guys stay in touch with everybody in their squad or platoon, you know? The band of brothers thing. Other guys, though,"
twirling again toward that middle-distance future,
"sometimes you just move on, you know?"
With this last statement, Shireese leaned down and kissed the top of her brother's head. With this, not with his account of his injuries and hellish recovery, but with this. Exactly why this gesture provoked something in Euclide, and what exactly it provoked, he cannot say. The kiss struck Euclide as a reluctant sanction, as if she didn't agree with something her brother was doing or saying, but supported him anyway. The kiss of a father releasing his daughter to a bridegroom he abhors. If it hadn't been for her, he'd later say, and the sheer volume of sub-rosa communication his antennae kept discerning, he wouldn't have posed the question that he did. Would have driven out of those woods, armed with an uncomplicated portrait of Cameron Harris. He feared repeating a common mistake of his as a prosecutor, bogging himself down trying to untie a peripheral knot that, tied or untied, would have little to no impact at trial, what Americans called missing the forest for the trees. But still, la sorella. Janice's suspicions about Cameron stayed viable every time Shireese flinched at his mention.
"Sergeant Lockwood," he began, steeling himself with formality, "I hope you'll understand why I must ask this question."
The look on DeMarcus's face caused Euclide to stall a moment. It suggested he knew precisely what was coming. "Given your knowledge of Cameron Harris,
Would you find it at all credible that some or all of his paralysis might not have been legitimate?
The twist of DeMarcus's face made clear this was not at all the question he was anticipating.
Legitimate?
That some or all of it could have been faked. He sprayed the word as much as spoke it.
Faked?
Maybe sometime later, after an earlier recovery of function.
The fuck for?
I don't know, Euclide said, unnerved by the way DeMarcus's nostrils were flaring and the sheen of rising fury Euclide could see in his eyes. Possibly to avoid returning to combat, possibly... DeMarcus spat a puff of disgusted air.
You ain't serious with that.
It's just something that needs to be excluded.
No, you can't come in my house talking shit like that.
I'm sorry, it's just...
You don't know shit. You know that?
Shireese was behind him now, spearing Euclide with her eyes, and with one hand kneading her brother's shoulder, the baby in her other arm beginning to mewl from the tensely raised voices.
You listen to me talk, and then you come out with that? You lay that shit down? You don't know fuck about nothing.
Euclide lifted both hands to show surrender. He tried to speak, but DeMarcus cut him off again.
You don't know the shit we went through. You don't know what shit is.
His eyes were brimming.
You got no fucking idea. Cameron Harris was the bravest, toughest soldier I ever served with. Never saw him half-step in my life.
His voice was catching, and he gulped for air. His quiet sergeant's authority was gone now, replaced by something wilder, more elemental, more dangerous. The baby let out a cry that could have come from somewhere inside DeMarcus.
Did you not fucking listen to what I was just telling you? You got something wrong with you?
Shireese's voice entered.
You see, Dee, this is why I told you don't do this. I don't care, you got questions you're supposed to ask,
DeMarcus said, ignoring her. Euclide tensed for DeMarcus to come leaping out of his chair.
They're bullshit questions. You don't get to come into my house talking shit like that. You can just get the fuck out of here. You not hearing me? Get the fuck out!
I told you, Dee, Shireese said. DeMarcus threw up his hand in another stop sign, but the effort broke him. He buried his face into the stump of his left arm and let out a low and grinding sob. Euclide sat drawing his lips into his mouth, jolted by a blast he hadn't seen coming, and would have left the house right then, concussed with confusion and guilt, were it not again for Shireese. She peered down at her weeping brother, her features softening so profoundly that it appeared her face was going out of focus, unraveling from pity or love, until, with a decisive nod, she hardened them back, aiming her eyes at Euclide.
There's something you should be knowing about my brother and Cameron, she said to him.
Sha, don't, DeMarcus's words muffling into his shirt sleeve.
What for?
She snapped downward.
I'm listening to you tell a story that ain't the real one.
Euclide perked. Though he was feeling something like the way DeMarcus had described feeling inside that courtyard, trapped inside a blender. Shards of emotion were buzzing around him, too fast to identify.
You ashamed, Dee? That why you sent Chief out?
The baby was wailing now, howling at the ceiling.
He don't care, and you know it. You ain't got no cause for shame, Dee. Only thing shameful is acting like the truth ain't true.
Sha, DeMarcus moaned, lifting his face just long enough for Euclide to see the flood smearing his cheeks, then burying it again. Her gaze froze Euclide.
My brother loved Cameron Harris.
Euclide groped to make sense of this, his arms rising as though to capture her words from the air and turn them over in his hands.
Well, sure, he said,
elongating his own words less from caution than bafflement. Combat duty creates... It must create incredible bonds, the shared trauma, and...
Nah, you ain't feeling me. My brother, he was in love with Cameron.
She looked down at DeMarcus's racking shoulders.
Shit. Look at you, Dee. You still is.
Chapter 17 36 hours after the panicked, shambolic retreat from Guidry's Lava Lounge on the afternoon of January 2, 2015, Scott T. Griffin was roaming his rented cottage in Ocean Springs, across Biloxi Bay, with his phone pressed to his ear. The rest of the crew, Caitlin, Honeybun, Casey, Croft, were draped on sectional couches, a funereal pall dulling their faces, Caitlin nibbling her fingernails one after the other. Honeybun tried lightening the mood with a batch of Bloody Marys, but no one seemed lightened, or for that matter, thirsty. Honeybun had to keep reminding everyone about the sweating crimson glasses in front of them, like a mom pushing cough syrup. On the coffee table was that morning's edition of the Sun Herald, read and reread, announcing a criminal inquiry into the fight by the Biloxi Police Department and the temporary suspension of filming.
"Look, Cameron didn't get paralyzed washing windows," they could hear Griffin saying. "He was a warrior. He got taken out in combat, okay? He was trained for violence, conditioned for violence, and then... No, Bree, please, just think about this for a minute. He had to sit for 4 years with all that violence running crazy through his veins."
Griffin's manic energy. He was flailing his pink arms, pounding walls and tables to punctuate what he was saying, grunting and gesticulating as though wicking the spirit of the James Brown t-shirt he was wearing, stood in total contrast to the zombies strewn on the couches. An hour before, Lifetime's Nicola Ash had issued a terse statement saying that, in light of the recent incident in Biloxi, Mississippi, the March 15th premiere of the series Miracle Man has been indefinitely postponed, sucking even more oxygen from the room. Griffin, however, wasn't seeing that as the airless omen everyone else was. "Saying indefinitely is like saying forever with an emoji," went Casey's mumbled reaction. In fact, Griffin was strangely relieved. Postponement meant a reprieve from the deadlines that had been shrieking after him every day, particularly in the last few weeks. It meant he had more editing time to hone narratives, to tweezer significance from the hundreds of hours of humdrum existence he'd filmed. Moreover, Griffin wasn't willing to concede that Cameron's assault doomed the show. Complicated it, yes, but only in ways that the documentarian in him was relishing. As Griffin saw it, the show until that point had been based on a situation. What he had now, he thought, was a story.
"Did he respond poorly to a provocation?"
he was saying to Bree Winterson, Lifetime's head of programming, patched into a conference call along with Griffin's agent and a phalanx of attorneys.
"Okay, yes, of course. But was that response really out of the blue?"
"No. That's what warriors do.
Is it a short-term loss? Absolutely. But long-term, for the show? Listen, I think this just added this massive dose of texture and complexity. I really do. The fact that he responded physically, after all those years when he couldn't? Cameron's not a saint, but come on, we knew that. He's not some Christian Superman. He's a bit of a meathead, okay, who took out some asshole in a bar fight. But I'm saying we should embrace that complexity. Let's pivot the show toward it, not away from it."
When he ended that call, the 20th or 30th he'd made or fielded since waking with a multi-layered hangover on New Year's Day, he'd convinced by his own reckoning somewhere between 0 and 0.25 people. But Griffin wasn't dissuaded. He wouldn't let himself be. Miracle Man had become like a vital organ to him, one of the only things pumping blood through his veins. Not just because his 12-year marriage had turned into a dumpster fire, indirectly ignited by this show, and not just because documenting Cameron Harris's story was the deepest project he'd ever undertaken, the thing he was counting on to prove he could do more than local color, that big themes weren't out of his reach, that he wasn't just an L.A. hustler, peddling moonshiners and jukers and truck-stop hookers from the deep-fried margins. If he lost the show, and the way Winterson kept saying, "Scotty, this just isn't the show we ordered," certified that as a looming possibility, he'd lose everything. The money, his crew, his investors, his reputation, any and all basis for convincing future network execs he could deliver a show. To be a producer, he's often said, your job is to produce. It's an infinitive verb. To not produce is to not exist. And that's what Scott T. Griffin, already homeless, already dazed and frayed, and currently listening to Casey and Croth comparing the westward flights they were scouting on their phones, felt that he was up against. The end of his existence as he knew it. All because of a single 1:30 a.m. punch in a gnarly little shit-kicker bar. Okay, more than one punch, but still. Honeybun rose from the couch to offer Griffin a look at his phone.
"Hollywood Reporter's got a story up," he announced. "Yeah, I figured. The writer called me this morning."
Griffin shooed the phone away.
This line producer from Fox and Friends called me a little while ago, looking for footage to use for B-roll on whatever they're doing. I politely told them they could blow me.
What does that sound like? Might you please consider blowing me?
Something like that, Griffin said absently. More of a British accent.
There's a meme rolling on Twitter, that Culture Club song, It's a Miracle, playing over cell footage of Cameron on top of the guy. You see it?
Saw it. First of many, I'm sure.
A sigh.
That tide's gonna keep rising.
At least it's Friday. Shit'll die down over the weekend.
Honeybun's features shifted into a lumpy frown.
So is Cameron answering yet?
Crickets,
Griffith said.
Not even texts?
Griffin shook his head, looking pained.
Tanya's saying to give him time.
He passed his own phone to Honeybun so he could read Tanya's last text message to him.
He's pretty tore up about everything, not sure what happened. I'll let you know when shit calms down.
She's not sure what happened? Handing it back.
Or he's not sure. You're reading it same as I am.
Honeybun crossed his arms.
You still don't think I'm right?
What I think and what everybody knows, Griffin said with a wide roll of his eyes, is that you've got the loosest gaydar settings in North America.
I said it that first night. At dinner, the very first night.
You were joking.
You took it as a joke. You take everything as a joke. Because it was a joke. I laugh at ridiculous shit, okay? Just like Roy Porter. You remember him? From the Hoss Trammell Show? How queer was he?
As a $3 bill? Look like Tarzan? Suck like Jane?
Jesus, Bun.
Griffin lifted his gaze to the ceiling.
You just hate anyone not being on your menu.
Oh, please. I just know a vegan option when I see it.
Look, said Griffin. That pained look back on his face. Can we do this some other time? When it'd be more fun? I kinda got too much going on to be entertaining your sexual fantasies right now. I'm trying to hold this fucking thing together. And by that, I'm talking about me.
Patting his chest.
As much as the show.
Of course. Sorry.
Honeybun backed away with his hands up.
I didn't mean to knock your blinders out of place.
Griffin's face nodded as he watched Honeybun walk away.
Anyway, he called after him. Gay guys don't fight like that.
Honeybun wheeled around.
Oh, right, I forgot. We just tickle and bite. Case closed, Javier.
Griffin's phone rang just as Casey was approaching him. Answering the call, he said to his agent,
Hold on, Roger, just one sec,
saying to Casey.
What is it?
Casey told him he'd found a flight out in the morning. He was booking it.
I really wish you'd give me some more time here,
Griffin said. If I'm going to be sitting on a couch not getting paid, shrugging, I'd rather be doing it back home with my lady. With his eyes closed tight, Griffin ran a hand across his forehead, as though wiping something thick and viscous from it.
If the network gets on board, he said slowly, and Cameron comes back online, these next few days are going to be our money shots. We're finally going to be cooking on a hot stove.
Dude, I'll be a phone call away, said Casey,
as emptily as Griffin had ever heard a person speak. Several hours later, on that same cold and drizzle gray Friday, across the bay in Biloxi, Dr. Janice Lorimar Cuevas was walking through the hospital's canteen when she passed a face she recognized. Janice hardly ever frequented the canteen, but she hadn't eaten a thing since her morning smoothie, a habit she understood she needed to change. She awakened vomiting the previous morning, and knowing this had nothing to do with the glass and a half of champagne she'd drunk at the Biloxi Yacht Club's New Year's Eve party, she immediately dispatched Naps to Walgreens. They watched the pregnancy test results emerge together, the green plus sign seeping into view beneath the little plastic window. Nap brought to speechless tears, and Janice sitting stunned on the edge of the bed, running the ramifications through her mind as a microprocessor assimilates data. She was pregnant. And now, a day after this discovery, she was feeling obliged to whet her already sharp habits, in this case to nourish that zygotic presence growing inside her, even if that meant stomaching canteen food. Janice reversed a few steps. The woman she'd recognized was sitting by herself, with a cardboard cup of mostly uneaten soup in front of her, its skimmed surface testifying to her disinterest. She had her palms pressed flat to the table, as though she'd decided to get up but abandoned the effort midstream. Every inch of her face and bust, the way her raw eyes were sagging, the downturned set of her mouth, the wayward strands of hair stuck to her forehead, the inward droop of her delicate shoulders,
was broadcasting distress.
You own the Busy Bee, right?
Janice said to her. Leyte Hatt looked up, nodding. She took Janice in with a slow, clunky focus.
Oh, you're his doctor. I saw you on TV one time.
Cameron, you mean? Hatt nodded again.
He won't answer his phone.
Her voice sounded tired and bitter, and not entirely directed Janice's way. Janice hesitated.
You saw the paper this morning?
Stupid, said Hatt, as though to spit the word into her soup. This was Janice's turn to nod, though what was stupidest about it, in her mind, was Cameron having quit his antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds 2 months earlier. Much of what had happened to Cameron in the preceding 4.5 months had shocked her. But not this. Having treated hundreds of PTSD sufferers over the years, veterans struggling with their return from Iraq or Afghanistan, she knew the syndrome's hallmarks. Hypervigilance, hypersensitivity, a loss of authority over anger. At 1:30 a.m., in a barroom, top-dressed with alcohol, unbuffered by any medications, it wasn't hard to imagine those hallmarks getting packed into a fist. With her patients who declined medication, she'd found, often the question wasn't if, but when, their fuse long or short, but almost always sparking.
It sure did sound that way, she said to Hatt. Why would he do that?
Hatt withdrew her hands from the table and gathered them into little fists of her own.
Someone who gets a miracle, they don't act that way.
Janice tilted her head.
What do you mean? God doesn't give a gift like that to someone who uses it for wrong.
Her fists were tight now, raised to her chest as though to spar.
Not when there's someone else who'd use it for good, when there's someone else who doesn't act like that.
Hatt clearly had someone specific in mind.
Are you here, Janice probed, to visit someone?
Hatt drew air into her nose and bobbed her head in staccato nods, but when she made to speak, nothing came out. Lubricating her voice with anger allowed it to emerge, though incoherently and in spurts.
They're letting him die. The doctors are, the ones over in that building. They're just letting him die.
Letting who die? Virgil Pullman was the answer. Gil. Hatt and Quinn had admitted him on December 29th. Through November and early December, the chemotherapy hadn't been working the way the VA oncologists liked to see, slowing the cancer rather than shrinking or stalling it. But then come Christmas, Gil showed a strange and rosy turnaround, a 4-day burst of vitality. No one mentioned it too deeply, so as not to curse it with scrutiny. But it was hard not to view it through the lens of hope, and furthermore through the lens filter of Christmas, as the miracle for which he and Hatt had been praying. Gil's energy spiked. He slept soundly through the night. He was lucid and engaging. And when a suntanned blonde in her 50s came into the store, he flirted with her so relentlessly that she looked burnt, not tanned, as she backed her way giggling out the door, reddened by the exuberance of the stick figure's attraction. Hatt tried broaching the miracle prospects with Quinn.
Do you think, could it be?
But he swiftly shut her down.
My brain can't take thinking about it, he gently snapped. It's too much, too much.
But she knew he was thinking about it. Same as she was. He was just too superstitious to admit it. For those 4 days, as she'd watched Gil laugh and eat and pray and appear to revert, if only flickeringly, to the Gil who'd come parachuting into their lives back in August, for those 4 days, all her doubts about Cameron that Euclide Abasha's questions had fertilized were subsumed by her hopes for Gil, by what she recognized as pure faith. If his turnaround was real, if Gil's cancer was retreating, if by some beautiful, sacred power Gil was being cured, then it meant that same power was what had lifted Cameron to his feet, too. And what that meant, she tried and failed not to think, was that the Busy Bee, like Lourdes, was the recipient of God's grace, not merely the site of healings, but their cause. Seeing little Kim nestled in Gil's toothpick arms on the couch, Hatt was struck dizzy by the notion of a link between him and Cameron and little Kim's against-all-odds recovery as an infant in the NICU, her breath stolen straight out of her lungs. And then it toggled off, just as suddenly as it had begun. Gil didn't rise at his new normal hour on December 29th, and 5 hours later still hadn't. When Hatt went in to check on him, She found him on his side, his body pearled with furious beads of sweat, his breathing slow and gurgly, bile yellowing his eyes. He didn't recognize Hat, mistaking her for his mother. He just couldn't milk the cows, he told her. Felt too sick to do it. Hat got a thermometer into him. 103.8 degrees. With that, she drove Gil to the Gulf Coast Veterans Hospital, which was where she'd been intermittently camping out, sometimes swapping shifts with Quinn, little Kim sometimes alongside her ever since. But no one was doing anything for Gil, so far as Hat could tell. The doctors and nurses, all the interchangeable white coats, seemed to be doing less than she'd been doing. Her, just a shopkeeper who'd accidentally adopted a scuffed-up old man from Alabama who'd shown up at her store carrying an inflatable crucifix. With leaky eyes, she said it again to Janice. I don't know why they're letting him die. Let me walk over with you, Janice offered, the sight of the congealing soup having quashed her appetite away. Maybe I can find something out for you. Entering Gil's room, in the acute inpatient ward 3 floors above her own office, Janice could see, without need to scan his chart, that Gil was dying. The skin of his arms was mottled and bluish, indicating decreased blood perfusion. His sleeping breathing was alternating rapid breaths with none at all, a pattern known medically as Chain-Stokes breathing, and a reliable sign of a heart shutting down. Still, she conferred with the nurse on duty. Gil had an infection his body wasn't fighting, the nurse told her. T-cell and neutrophil counts were bottoming out. They were administering antibiotics and a blood growth stimulant, but at this point, with system failure setting in, palliative care was really the only course remaining. Janice and the nurse glanced down the hallway to where Hat stood watching them, with her hands bunched at her middle. She has medical POA if you want to talk to her, the nurse said. He might surprise us, but I think it's a matter of hours. Janice gently pulled Hat into the room, the heart monitor dripping a too slow cadence of beeps. No one's letting him die, Mrs. Leigh, she told her. There just isn't anything left to do to stop it. That's not true, Hat whispered, scrunching her face as if to prevent her from inhaling Janice's words. They just need to give him a little more time. They can do that. This didn't strike Janice as an abstract appeal for time, that indefinite extension for which family members commonly pleaded. Janice was censoring a feather edge of specificity again. More time for what?
For the miracle, Hat blurted.
And seeing Janice's face harden, if only slightly, she sped her voice into a wet rush.
He almost had it. Last week, we saw it. If they'll just look at the cancer, they'll see it too. It was happening, I swear it was. You've seen this happen, you know. This is just what he's got. It's a cold. That's what they told me. He can't die from a cold. If they just look at the cancer.
She stumbled forward in what Janice first thought was a faint, Janice throwing her arms out to catch her. Then to her surprise, Janice found herself holding the small woman who was weeping into her shoulder.
It's okay, Janice whispered. It's okay.
Hat threw her head back, her eyes slick and smeary.
I don't even know him, she said, swatting in the direction of the bed. He came to the store after what happened to Cameron. My husband was right. It was crazy to let him stay.
She wiped her nose and cheeks with the side of her hand, looking astounded by the wetness there.
Why am I crying? I never cry. Why am I crying?
Because you're losing someone, Janice said. It was all she could think to say, though something told her, rightly, that there was more to it than that. Or not rightly, in a sense, because Hat, in that instant, realized that she was losing someone. Only it wasn't Gil. It was God. This realization came more as a physical sensation than a thought, something bursting inside her and leaving in its place a dark and vacant hollow. It wasn't rational, even by the standards of faith, and in some sense it was profoundly and grotesquely irrational. Witnessing a miracle, and despite her doubts, that was still what she believed she'd seen, should have buttressed her faith, she thought, should have stiffened it beyond measure. And yet, in some paradoxical way, it provoked instead a crisis in faith, conferring upon her less an affirmation than a test. The photo-negative of biblical trials in which calamity wobbles faith, but wondrous signs cement it. God granting Cameron his legs while bequeathing nothing to Gil. It wasn't that Hat deemed Gil more deserving than Cameron, despite what she'd said earlier to Janice. That had just been her voicing her frustration at the terrible asymmetry. Cameron smacking a guy in a bar as Gil lay gasping. No, it was the randomness of it, the unaccountable unfairness of it all. And with this in mind, she flashed back to when she was an 8-year-old girl on that creaking wooden boat out in the Gulf of Thailand. Her head burrowed into the lap of the elderly nun, counting off her Hail Marys with the same slow meter of Gil's heart monitor. It had never crossed her mind that there were other girls, clutching other nuns in the exact same way, who hadn't survived that same voyage, who'd been raped and thrown overboard by pirates, and that perhaps the nun's placid certitude, so long inspiring, was in fact a kind of indifference. Everything is okay, until it isn't. A baleful shudder ran through her, eliciting more pats on her back from Janice. Like an audience to this realization, in her mind's eye, came the faces of all the people who'd cavalcaded the busy bee these past 4 months, seeking healing inside that 8-by-12-foot orange rectangle painted on the asphalt. What had she and Quinn been providing them? Selling them, really. No one had spent more time inside that rectangle than Gil. Long, faith-cooled hours in the sun. And look at him now. Whatever had happened to Cameron, divinely wrought or otherwise, had nothing to do with the store, she decided, had nothing whatsoever to do with that postage stamp of crumbly asphalt. She'd get Ollie to scrub the paint from the parking lot tomorrow, she thought. She didn't care what Quinn would say. It wasn't right to encourage people to stand there. It wasn't. She looked up, blinking at Janice, as though emerging from a dream. Janice asked if she was okay, and Hat shivered her head yes, embarrassed to have wept on this stranger, apologizing for the damp splotches on her white coat as she pulled herself away, seeking tissues. "Let's just sit a spell," Janice said, leading Hat to a chair beside Gil's bed. Furtively, she checked the time. Nap had gone and spilled the pregnancy news to his parents, despite Janice's admonition not to do so at this early stage, and they'd be arriving for dinner shortly. But Janice wasn't late yet. Plus her father-in-law, much like her own father, never begrudged an elongated cocktail hour. Janice asked about Gil's family. Yes, Hat told her, she'd gotten in touch with them. An ex-wife and a daughter were coming from Birmingham that night, albeit reluctantly. Gil hadn't been the best husband and father back in his drinking days, Gil himself admitted that, and the ex-wife's and daughter's tones had seemed to confirm it. Janice wasn't naive. She knew how humanity operated, but something about that estrangement struck her as unimaginable. The baby inside her was almost nothing, manifest only as a morning's vomit and a plus sign on a plastic test stick. And yet, just 2 days in, she felt overcome by maternal resolve. By a sterling willingness to sacrifice anything and everything for that faint glimmer of an embryo. The centrality and importance of her own life had already begun to fade, its energy transferring to the presence in her womb. Hearing someone else articulate this, she would have blithely chalked it up to hormones. Yet this felt anything but chemical. Eventually, as Gil beside them wheezed, then stopped, each cycle alarming Hat anew, their conversation narrowed to the person connecting them. "Earlier, when we were in the canteen," Janice reminded her, "you said Cameron wasn't answering. Have you been in touch with him since what happened yesterday morning?"
"Oh, Gil wanted to see him," she said offhandedly.
"Gil did? Why's that?"
"He wanted to tell him about some movie."
Hat wasn't familiar with the film, but from the loose and second-hand description Hat gave her, Janice was. Gil was talking about Saving Private Ryan, a World War II drama from the late 1990s.
"I didn't really understand," Hat told her. "There was something someone says in that movie that Gil wanted to say to Cameron."
Janice leaned forward in her chair, dropping her head between her shoulders, knowing exactly the line Gil wanted to quote to Cameron. The army captain, played by Tom Hanks, said it, as he lay blood-soaked and dying, to Matt Damon's character, for whom he'd given his own life and those of 4 of his men to rescue. Janice saw the scene playing in her head. He grabbed him by the collar, pulled him weakly to him. "Earn this," is what he'd said. "Earn it." The twilit gulf lay like a vast and luminous purple bruise to her right as Janice drove home along the beach on U.S. 90, until she passed her exit for the Back Bay Bridge and was no longer headed home. The landscapes of her life, it occurred to her, had always been flat, first as a child in the Mississippi Delta, with level fields of cotton stretching in every direction, and then as a woman and physician, and now a freshly minted mother-to-be on the coast, with that blue pane of salt water, her southward vista. Nothing had ever impeded her horizons, or for that matter, drawn her toward them. They'd never been anything other than crisp lines. This realization struck her as both meaningful and meaningless at the same time, if anything, proof that she wasn't thinking clearly. She turned left on Calivet Street and dialed Knapp.
"Wait," he said. "You're doing what?"
She needed to see Cameron, she told him, stringing on a second apology. His voice went blank. He didn't understand at all. In his mind, the two of them had already indicted Cameron as a fraud, the Morning Sun Herald article having validated not their suspicions, but rather their inklings about an unsavory aspect to Cameron's story. It's more than meets the eye quality.
And what about dinner with his parents? The five of them needed to celebrate.
Janice did some quick math to realize he was counting hers, too, setting a sweet but very premature place setting for the tiny packet of Cueva cells occupying her belly. She turned onto Division Street.
"Cameron might not want to talk to me," she told Knapp,
who, bewilderment and disappointment aside, was still too buoyed by the pregnancy news to catch what she knew was in her voice, the tautness of a steel bridge cable. Knapp could be dippy at times, a quality she mostly adored. He was going to make a terrific father.
"He might not even be home," she said. "And in that case, I won't hardly be late at all. Just tell your parents I had an emergency call. Leave it open. I'll text you."
She hadn't identified the emotion tugging her toward Reconfort Avenue as anger until she was parked in front of the Harris house and turned off her car, realizing the vibrations she still felt weren't from the engine, but from her own body. She gripped the steering wheel for calm, as if to absorb some of its mechanical logic. For one thing, she reminded herself, the hospital's information technology administrator had the week before detonated a larger hole in her theory. The VA's VISTA system, he told her, was essentially hack-proof. It logged every access and recorded every change to a patient's file, and while maybe some teenage savant in Ukraine could figure out how to subvert that logging, it was way beyond the capacity, he said with a light sneer, of any federal employee. Cameron's file, then, was Cameron's file. What it showed was what was there. Yet her theory remained standing. Emotion and intuition and maybe a smidgen of denial propping it up in the places where its foundation blocks were missing, with a surge of indignation currently jacking it up even higher in Janice's mind. If her suspicions were right, and Cameron's recovery was indeed a hoax, his list of victims now extended beyond her and the United States government. Gil Pullman was on that list, and also Hat, whose tears had probably yet to dry on Janice's lab coat back at the hospital. Whether he'd intended to or not didn't matter. Cameron had supplied them with false hopes about their own existences. He'd stolen reality from them. He'd let Gil Pullman go to his death feeling excluded from painfully proximal glory, feeling forsaken upon his own inflatable cross. This wasn't abstract anymore, a crime against bureaucracy. This was sowing hurt. The lights were on in the house. Cameron and Tanya's twin pair of showroom-glinting new cars out front. Janice steamed up the walkway and rang the bell. Tanya answered. The squint she gave Janice was bedraggled and confused, as if she didn't recognize her at all. And maybe she didn't, Janice allowed, outside of her lab-coated medical context. Janice identified herself. The pallid shade of Tanya's skin and the nauseated look on her face gave her the appearance of someone who'd been binging on bleach and soda highballs. She was partly blocking the doorway. "Can I see your brother?" Janice asked, adding when Tanya failed to respond, "It's about his medications." Not quite a fib. Tanya's eyes popped a bit, as though Janice had just slipped her a crucial clue to something, and she eased backward to let her in. Janice's anger went draining out of her the moment she saw Cameron. He was propped shirtless on the couch, sitting upright but curled into something close to the fetal position against the armrest, his wrapped right hand over his head, as though to hold his skull together or shield it from invisible blows. When he lowered the hand and revealed his face to Janice, she felt a long shudder run through her. Here was the same broken-looking boy she'd first encountered on an exam table 3 years ago. His eyes hazed now as then, with incomprehension and dread. That giant tattoo of the angel-winged infantryman beside the prayer to the Archangel Michael, still somehow out of place on his licensed torso. A mistaken branding.
"Let me see that hand," was the first thing she said to him.
The hand was wrapped too tightly. She could see puffed flesh where the wrapping ended at his wrist. Unspooling it, she found the outside of his hand swollen and the same shade of purple as the gulf had appeared on her drive over.
"Move your fingers for me," she commanded,
Cameron gingerly forming a claw.
"Have you been icing it?"
she asked, Cameron nodding.
"Tanya, will you get us some more ice?"
she said.
"And do you know if you have any cortisone cream or some other anti-inflammatory cream?"
Tanya asked.
"Did I wrap it too tight?"
"No, honey, just a little too snugly. You don't want to cut off the circulation." Tanya returned with a bag of frozen butter beans, which Janice applied to Cameron's hand.
"We don't got any creams," Tanya said. "Reckon they sell it at the Busy Bee. I can run over."
Janice locked eyes with Cameron.
"I'm thinking you're probably going to need to make a pharmacy run."
To Cameron, she said, "You ready to think about restarting your meds?" Tanya emitted a low hiccup of shock.
"Restarting?"
Cameron sat blinking at Janice, lifting an unlit cigarette to his lips.
"You can tell her," she said to him.
He lit the cigarette, twin funnels of gray smoke exiting his nose. "I went off my meds."
"When?"
"A couple months ago."
"The hell for?"
Cameron threw up his hand as if to shoo a horsefly. "Because I didn't think I needed them no more," he said. "Because, I mean, look at me." It was an abysmally wrong time to solicit an assessment, which Cameron seemed to grasp even as the words left his mouth. He'd just disproven his own point. The shoo-fly defensiveness disappeared from his tone as he said quietly, "It just seemed like if my legs was working, then my brain was working too. I don't know. I just didn't think I needed them no more."
"Well, you're a stone dumbass," came Tanya's judgment. "And you didn't think to tell me that? The way you've been acting? Now this thing with Landry?"
Her voice trailed off as pieces went clicking together in her head.
"I think he knows it was a mistake," Janice said,
looking to Cameron for confirmation. He dipped his head yes, squinting as he exhaled a stream of smoke.
"Look," she said to him, "I don't know what happened with this fight, and whether you staying on the medications would have helped it not happen. What I do know is that they help keep you together up there, that they help prevent stress and anxiety from letting you come unglued. Is that what happened?"
"Yeah." He combined a nod with a shrug. "I just lost my shit." Janice excused herself to get a prescription pad from her car. When she returned, the air in the room felt sheared, as though sharp words had just been hurled. She started scribbling out prescriptions, Cameron helping to remind her of his old jilted regimen. She added some Valium, too, to help him over this hump.
"You tired of talking about it yet?" she said about the fight.
"A little," he said, his expression suggesting a lot. He stabbed out his cigarette, then picked at the bag of butter beans chilling his hand. "I had to turn myself into the police this morning. Got fingerprinted and all that. Tanya was so messed up about it, had to get Father Ace to come post bond."
Tanya muttered cryptically, "I ain't messed up about that."
"Is he put out with you?" Janice asked, passing the sheaf of prescriptions to Tanya. "Not really, no. He told me this story about having to knock the sand out of some dude in his village back in Africa, this big guy who'd drink cooking fuel and go crazy picking on folks. Them priests over there, I guess they gotta act like cops sometimes."
"Is that what you did? Knock the sand out of someone trying to pick a fight with you?"
"Something like that," Cameron said distantly.
"It was just some jackass from high school," Tanya interjected, "saying Cameron didn't earn his medals or something."
Cameron flinched.
and Janice watched his face and body go tense. She could actually see it in his bared abdominal muscles, the way they contracted into a rutted grid. He shook his head, and without looking at his sister, said to her, "We ain't gonna do that, Tan. I told you that."